It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll find out why bats deserve our affection and protection.
First, new data from the U.S. Department of Education shows that the graduation gap between white and black students in the 2013 and 2014 school year got bigger.
That makes Wisconsin's graduation gap the largest in the country. The graduation rate for white students in the Badger State is third in the nation, but our ranking for African-American students is 40th nationally.
State Superintendent Tony Evers created a task force to address the racial achievement gap in Wisconsin. And last year, the group called Promoting Excellence for All released their report. Damon Means is the chairperson for Promoting Excellence for All, and he joins us to talk about these new numbers and his work on the task force. Damon is also the superintendent for the Mequon-Thiensville School District. Damon, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, what was your first reaction when you heard about these new numbers from the U.S. Department of Education today?
Well, I think the reaction is one of disappointment and just a sense of urgency being rekindled for our state to focus on closing our achievement gap, which we know continues to be the largest in the United States.
Now, in Wisconsin, according to this new data, there are other racial groups that did move up in terms of graduation rates. And it seems that in this case, African Americans are an outlier. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think in terms of the state of Wisconsin, we have to keep in mind that African-American high school graduation rates did increase by 0.2%. The problem is that when you compare it to other subgroups, in particular Caucasian students also grew, and that created the gap. I think that we have to continue to work on finding solutions in the classroom to become more culturally relevant when teaching young people, but we also have to collectively as a community refuse to be color mute and clearly embrace the fact that we have children of color, specifically African American students across our state, who are not achieving at the level that they should achieve at. But at the same time, our task force title was Promoting Excellence for All, and I can tell you that in the Mequon-Thiensville School District, and what we tried to emphasize with our task force is that we have to look at all students and make sure that all students are achieving their true best and maximizing their potential academically, socially, and emotionally.
And you just used the phrase there, color mute, and that we should refuse to be color mute in our education system. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by it is that typically, teachers will make the statement that I don't see color, that the struggles that certain students have based on the home environment they come from or what color they are should not matter, that once they're in the classroom, we should be able to teach students universally. And that's just not true. That's minimizing what those young people bring into the classroom that's unique to them. So it's imperative that we focus on the uniqueness of every child and make sure that we're reaching their full potential through tapping into their talents.
And the Promoting Excellence for All Task Force released their report last year, and you focused on four areas. Can you tell us about those areas?
Absolutely. So there were four areas we believe are high leverage focus areas. And the first is effective instruction. That's followed by family engagement, student-teacher relationships, and school and instructional leadership. We believe that when you utilize our toolkit, and we call it a toolkit, when you utilize our toolkit, that you can take strategies from our recommendations and really transform your school and your school district if you would like to close the achievement gap. I use the terminology, if you would like to close the achievement gap, because we also know that this is tough work and that it's going to take a long time. We will not have the ability to just snap our fingers and close the gap. It's going to take persistence on the role of educators to close the gap.
And what do you see as being some of the initial changes or moves toward those four areas improvement that you've seen in the last year since the report came out?
Well, what we're seeing under school and instructional leadership is a concerted focus on collecting data. Under school and instructional leadership, for example, data analysis is really important. And so what we're finding is that school districts all across our state are honing in and really focusing on collecting good data. We're finding that there's an increase in hiring instructional coaches across the state of Wisconsin. People are diving into our Promoting Excellence for All toolkit, and they're utilizing the strategies that we've highlighted. There are a number of different strategies under each of the four high-leverage focus groups and focus areas, and we would encourage any school or school district to utilize all of those areas. But we're finding that that schools and school districts are utilizing our strategies. We're very pleased about this element of progress for our state.
We're talking to Damon Means right now, superintendent of the Mequon-Thiensville School District and chairperson for the Promoting Excellence for All Task Force. He's talking about some new data out today showing that Wisconsin's graduation rate gap between white and black students is the largest in the nation. And Damon, we've been talking about some of these changes and areas of focus moving forward. And obviously, you can't change things overnight. Things take time to develop. But what sort of positive signs do you think that we're seeing despite these numbers?
Well, as I stated earlier, we do know that most of our subgroups in the state of Wisconsin saw an increase in high school graduation rates from the 2012-13 school year to the 13-14 school year. Unfortunately, as we stated earlier, we've also seen that increase within the majority of students, our Caucasian students, and that widened the gap between African-American and white students in Wisconsin. But there's some encouragement out there, and that encouragement is that we're seeing a slight uptick in high school graduation. But we need more. We need more progress for these young people. We know as a state that if we do not close the gap, that we're failing. We're failing our state in three major areas. The first is social justice. We're not living up to the social justice element that and promise that we all say that we want in our society. We're failing in terms of accountability. Educators must be accountable for ensuring that every student is reaching his or her academic potential. And then finally, we're failing from an economic standpoint. We are wasting human capital if we continue to allow Wisconsin, of all the states in the United States, if we continue to allow Wisconsin to have the largest achievement gap in the country, then shame on us because we're wasting human capital, and that should not be our status as a state.
Do you see any structural barriers that haven't been dealt with yet toward closing this graduation gap?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at our Promoting Excellence for All Task Force work, we honed in and focused on what we could do at the school level. And just this past August, our Promoting Excellence for All Task Force reconvened, and we met with deans of education, schools of education. I think the next step for our task force, if the business community is interested in sitting down with us, if legislators are interested in sitting down with us, it's imperative that we pivot and we start talking with corporate leaders, business titans of our state, to talk about how they can assist us in closing the gap. And at the same time, we would love an opportunity to sit down with our legislators to talk about how we can work together and not be on opposite sides of an ideological war, but to focus on how we can close the gap together, legislators and educators together.
Damon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity and appreciate the chance to talk about how this state can move out of the worst situation in the country and improve ourselves in terms of closing the gap. Thank you.
That was Damon Means, superintendent of the Mequon-Thiensville School District and chairperson for the Promoting Excellence for All Task Force. He was with us to talk about new data out today showing Wisconsin's graduation rate has a gap between white and black students that is the largest in the nation.
Bats have been feared throughout history, and their behavior has often been seen as threatening or even dangerous.
But in fact, we rely on bats for pest control, and a lot of the crops that we count on, like bananas and cocoa, wouldn't be possible without bats as pollinators.
Joining us now is Merlin Tuttle. He's the founder of Bat Conservation International and has been studying bats for more than 50 years. His brand new book is The Secret Lives of Bats. Merlin, welcome to Central Time.
I'm delighted to be able to join you today.
Well, I will say right up front that I'm a huge fan of bats, so I'm really happy to be talking with you about it. There are a lot of fascinating animals in the world. Clearly, you think bats are right at the top of the list. How did you decide to study them?
Well, it's hard not to be incredibly fascinated by bats. There are more than 1,300 species of bats worldwide. They come from tiny little guys that weigh a third less than a penny to giants with six-foot wingspans. They're incredibly sophisticated. They have social systems very similar to those of higher primates and dolphins. They adopt orphans. They help others in need. They share information. They can live up to 41 years in the wild, which is the equivalent of a human living to be 100 and still being able to run sprints through obstacle courses.
And you've been studying bats for more than half a century. When you first started, sort of the early years, people sounds like sort of thought you were crazy. Why did they think that?
Well, when I began studying bats, most people thought they were nothing but dirty, rabid vermin. And that's very unfortunate. We simply tend to fear what we don't understand, and bats are active mostly at night and often live in places where people can't see them very well. It's fascinating to recognize that in parts of the world where bats have 3 to 5, 6 foot wingspans and live out in the open like birds, that people not only don't fear them, but often eulogize them as folk heroes. It's where they're small and hard to see and more difficult to understand that so many of us have misunderstood and feared bats needlessly.
So, Merlin, you founded Bat Conservation International in 1982, and you gave up a job at the Milwaukee Public Museum to move that organization to Austin, Texas. Why Austin?
Austin at the time was generating more negative publicity about bats than probably all the other places in the world combined. There were hundreds of thousands of bats just beginning to move into newly created crevices under a bridge in the center of Austin. And public health officials were predicting that these bats were going to be largely rabid, would attack people, were dangerous. People of Austin were panicking and signed petitions to have them eradicated. But I figured that any town that had that many bats and that many news media with nothing better to do than talk about them would be an ideal location for educating people about the value of living harmoniously with bats. So I relocated Bat Conservation International to Austin, and although people think it must have been a huge job, it really wasn't that hard to show people how safe it really can be to live with bats. Now, 35 years later, having spent that whole time with 1.5 million bats under our bridge in the center of Austin, Texas, not one person has been attacked, not one person has contracted disease from a bat. But now we know that that one colony is eating 15 tons of insects a night and that they're bringing in $12 million tourist dollars every summer. So it has turned out to be exactly what I hoped it would be, a model example of how humans can benefit from living with bats.
And what are the lessons learned from that? I mean, I've been to Austin. I know that that community has embraced those bats. They're a tourist attraction now. So what can other communities learn from that?
Well, first of all, the values of bats vary depending on where you are in the world, but there's no place in the world where bats aren't extremely valuable, except in the very few where there aren't any bats. Bats live virtually everywhere where humans live, except in the most extreme polar and desert regions. And you can take any part of the world, and I can give you a great example of why bats are really important there.
Please do.
Okay. In Texas, for example, one of the first places that I set as a target for protection was the world's largest remaining bat population in Bracken Cave. The 10 to 20 million bats there have enormous agricultural impact. In fact, it's best understood, perhaps, if we just think about the fact that each spring, billions of corn earworm and armyworm moths fly north into the United States out of Mexico and Central America, and as they come in, each female is carrying 500 to 1,000 eggs. And our bats fly up to thousands of feet above ground to intercept these invaders, And each time they eat one of those moths, they're destroying 500 to 1,000 eggs. That means that if one of our bats eats only half of its nightly capacity in these moths, that it will prevent 10 to 20,000 eggs from being laid on Texas crops. That's enough to force a Texas farmer to spray multiple acres with pesticides at a cost of $74 an acre. That's the impact of one bat. Mm-hmm. And then we have millions of bats which are eating up to 100 tons or more of insects in a single night.
I believe that the figure here in Wisconsin is actually over $1 billion a year that bats are saving farmers in things like pesticides that you're talking about.
Yes. In fact, it can be argued probably very accurately that our bats in Texas are helping farmers in Wisconsin, because the corn earworm moths, as they migrate into Texas, they come down and lay eggs on Texas crops, and then when those eggs mature into more adults, they migrate another 500 or so miles north and sit down and lay more eggs. And this goes on all summer until they finally reach Wisconsin, where they attack corn there too and other crops. But by having our bats intercept them by the billions and eat them in Texas, it reduces the number that have a chance to reach Wisconsin.
The week leading up to Halloween is designated as Bat Week, and we are talking with Merlin Tuttle. He's the founder of Bat Conservation International, and we're discussing his book, The Secret Lives of Bats, My Adventures with the World's Most Misunderstood Mammals. Now, Merlin, you've literally risked your life on multiple occasions in your pursuit of bats. I'm guessing those are some of the adventures that you mentioned in the title of your book. Tell us about some of the lengths you've had to go to study bats.
Excuse me?
Tell us about some of your adventures in trying to get into those difficult places.
Well, having traveled literally all continents where bats exist, I have run into some very interesting experiences. Interestingly, for all people fear bats, none of my scary experiences involve bats. They all involved people or other animals that I encountered while I was looking for bats. I've been captured twice by communist insurgents. I've been shot at by moonshiners.
Wow.
I've been charged by elephants, stalked by lions and tigers, ended up sharing a passage in a cave with a big cobra. I've had a lot of pretty exciting experiences, but what most people might be surprised at is that it's not bats that I've had to worry about. It's all the other creatures, mostly humans.
Oh, wow, that's a lot of adventures all in the pursuit of bats. So having gotten so up close and personal with bats over the years, do you have any particular affection in your heart for any particular species of bats?
I tend to like best the ones I've spent the most time with. The first bats that I spent a lot of intense close-up time with after early on studying gray bats were the frog-eating bats I talk about in my book. And in those days, none of us had any idea how smart bats really were. And so I was probably the first person who discovered that bats could actually be trained just like dogs to do various things, come on call, go places on command. And one of the amazing things is that we found that bats that were trained to come on call to our hand for research purposes, even though we only trained them for a few nights, when they were released and marked and recaptured 1 to 2 years later, they still remembered to come on call to our hand.
And so, Merlin, you know a lot about bats. Are there still things about bat biology or migration or like you said, their social structures that are still mysteries that are yet to be studied?
Oh, the world of bats is an absolute wide-open frontier for new discoveries. When I started out, I actually discovered 5 new species in a new genus on one trip. And people are still discovering new species routinely. Even if you look at the species we already have described, most of them have not been more than superficially studied to describe them. And yet we're discovering new things all the time. Just this past year, my wife and I went to Borneo to photograph little woolly bats that weigh less than a nickel. And they've just recently been discovered to live in pitcher plants. Pitcher plants normally eat whatever enters, whether it's an insect or even a rat. And yet here's a bat that figured out how to live in pitcher plants, and it's turned out to be such a good relationship that the pitcher plants actually have developed echo reflectors to help guide the bats approaching so that they can find the entrance to the pitcher more easily, and have supplied special living quarters for bats.
Wow.
And these little bats, and one thing I should mention also is that although I did found Bat Conservation International, I'm very proud of the organization, I also have founded another organization since then, Merlin Tuttle's Bat Conservation. And if you look at merlintuttle.com, go there and look at our blogs for September a year ago, you'll find one where you'll see my wife Paula took video of these little woolly bats training me. Here are these little bats, so tiny, they only weigh 4 grams. That's only about a gram more than a U.S. penny, and nobody thought they could even be kept in captivity. They're tiny little fragile things.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Merlin, thank you so much for joining us, and we leave it there. Merlin Tuttle is the founder of Bat Conservation International, founded that in 1982. His latest book is called The Secret Lives of Bats.
A new report out this week from the Institute for College Access and Success finds some pretty stark numbers on college affordability in Wisconsin. In the last decade, the average student debt in Wisconsin grew 74%. A 2004 college graduate would have been looking at an average of about $16,000 in debt. In 2014, that number grew to around $29,000.
In addition, the percentage of students in Wisconsin graduating with debt rose to 70%, which is the third highest among states. So how exactly did we get to this point, and can this trend of rising college costs be turned around?
Here with us now to talk more about college debt in the state is Sarah Goldrick-Robb, founding director of the Wisconsin Hope Lab and professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So according to this report, in the last decade, we've seen the average student debt in the state shoot up 74%. Just how significant would you say that finding is?
I'd say that it's very significant, and I think that there are people all over Wisconsin and their families who would say that it's significant, that it's very much affecting them and their decision-making right now.
And there are people that will say, well, everything's getting more expensive overall. Are these numbers just a reflection of inflation, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, no, not at all. It's not simply a reflection of inflation. These college costs are rising much faster than inflation, much faster than most things. And there are many reasons for this, but they have a lot to do with policy choices that have been made over the last decade. And they also have to do with what's been happening to families in terms of their employment and their wages over the last decade.
Well, let's zero in on some of those. So you said some of it is due to public policy decisions and implementation. What specifically would you point to as part of the reason for that spike in college debt?
Well, it's important to first know that most college students in this state continue to go to college in the public sector. And what that means is that when they think about where they're going to go, they usually turn to either the University of Wisconsin system or to the Wisconsin Technical Colleges. The enrollment in this state in the private colleges, and in we're still lucky that we don't have too much enrollment in the for-profit colleges, that continues to be low. So the main things that we need to look at is how are the costs of higher education being covered in the public sector, and how much of the costs of providing that education are being covered by state government versus the individual person who has to pay for college themselves, you know, or for their family members.
So,
and what we're seeing over time are choices that essentially pass those costs on to the individual student rather than sharing those costs among taxpayers.
So that's an interesting point, Sarah. So are you saying that the actual cost, say, per student of a college education what's being expended to educate someone in college has not necessarily gone up. It's more the balance of who's paying for that?
That's exactly right. And very unfortunately, the words we use in higher education are not very good. The truth is a cost is what it actually costs to educate. And the cost is not changing all that much. What's changing is the price. The price is going up, and it's the price that the individual person pays because somebody else isn't subsidizing it anymore. And so that's the policy decision. You know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, more importantly, Wisconsin taxpayers did more sharing of the burden of paying for higher education together so that an individual who was trying to decide whether to go and pay and go to college wouldn't be scared off from higher education by the price point. Over time, we have made public policy decisions that basically put the bill on the individual, and frankly, it is scaring them now.
So you're saying that the cost, the price tag, maybe we should say, the price tag that individuals are taking on to get a college education is going up. And what are the family level dynamics and economics that are then affecting their ability to do that?
Right. Well, you know, families are having a hard time. I mean, I think all over the state, people know that while in the 80s and 90s, most families saw an increase in their income over the decade, in real terms, in the last decade, our incomes across the board have stagnated or declined for everyone outside the top 5%. Okay? So very few people are getting ahead these days. In contrast, these prices are going up. So let me give you a few numbers that I think might startle your listeners a little bit. And these numbers are about 3 years old. They're the most recent available data, but you should expect that today's numbers are even worse. So the out-of-pocket cost for a person who's going to go to one of our Wisconsin technical colleges after all grants and scholarships, okay, so I've already taken that discount into account, we're looking at $8,000 a year. We're looking at UW college price tags of over $6,000 a year. And for a year at one of our wonderful universities, we're talking usually about $9,000 a year or more after all grants have been taken into account. Covering that $9,000 a year amount is honestly quite hard, even for people who are earning, you know, say $40,000 a year. They don't get to devote all that money to paying for their child's tuition. It's more than tuition, but for paying for college.
So earlier we talked about the fact that the college debt load has gone up 74%, but also students in Wisconsin are graduating who are graduating with debt rose to 70%, which is the third highest among states. Now, in the past, Wisconsin, especially those private college or I'm sorry, public colleges, Wisconsin was seen as a pretty affordable place to get a really high quality education. Is that no longer the case?
It isn't the case. And I think that the problem here is that we haven't been hearing the alarm bells that are, you know, sounding. This is a pretty big one. It used to be the case that somebody who chose to go to college in the public sector would have such an affordable opportunity that if they worked while in school, they could make ends meet and not have to graduate with debt. These prices are so substantial now that working while in college doesn't cut it anymore. They have to borrow and work. And part of that, frankly, is also because work doesn't pay like it used to. I'm sure many of your listeners did things like I did, which is like waiting tables to go through college. I think people know that today the tips don't add up like they used to. The taxes are higher than they used to be. And really importantly, employers do not give college students the kind of hours they need to cover these costs. They do not just say you can have 30 hours a week if that's what you need. They tend to give out 10-hour increments. And so we have college students who are working 2 and 3 jobs and borrowing for college. Frankly, those numbers you have there, those, I hate to say it, those are the good stories because at least the students graduated. The real crisis today is the people who don't graduate and have debt.
Well, and one of the topics that you look at frequently, Sarah, is for-profit colleges and how that fits into this whole landscape of education and educational debt. How do for-profit colleges fall into that? And define a for-profit college for us.
Absolutely. So for-profit colleges are private institutions that utilize the revenue generated not to plow back into the education of students, but to plow into profit. And for-profit institutions in the United States have taken off rapidly in the last 20 years. Enrollment has been growing very quickly. Some government intervention more recently has helped to stem that. But a very important recent report came out that looked at the really bad student debt out there, the kind of debt where people are defaulting and ruining their credit. And they found that the two main drivers of the increases in that bad debt are, number one, for-profit colleges and universities, and number two, changes in the price at community colleges where states have disinvested. Now, in Wisconsin, we have about 200 for-profit institutions. They enroll about 60,000 students. I'm very concerned that if we're not careful to make our public institutions a good option for students, an affordable one, they will turn to the for-profits. And the for-profit institutions will set their prices as high as they can because people will go to them because they're accessible and they seem affordable because they offer them the loans up front. But very few students graduate, and when they do, they have a ton of debt. This is a very dangerous sector.
We're talking right now with Sarah Goldrick-Robb, professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison, and we're looking at college debt in Wisconsin. A new study finds that the average student debt in Wisconsin grew 74% in the last decade.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a recent college graduate, did you graduate with debt? How much debt? Are you optimistic about your ability to pay it off? And do you think there's a way to make college more affordable here in Wisconsin? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Education policy expert Sarah Goldrick-Robb is with us, and we're talking about rising college debt in Wisconsin. According to a new study, the average student debt has gone up significantly in the last decade, and we're taking a look at what can be done about the rising cost of college.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a recent graduate who had to take out loans, what is your outlook on things? How much debt are you facing? And what do you see as a solution to the ongoing issue of rising college debt? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So this report, Sarah, only reflects those who have graduated. What about students who take out loans and don't graduate? It seems like that's a double whammy. They don't have the credentials or the background of a college degree, but they have a lot of the debt.
That's right. And that is really the most heartbreaking situation because, you know, even a couple of decades ago, it was possible for a young person, or any person, honestly, to think to themselves, I think I'd like to try college. You know, I'm not sure what other alternatives there are to me. And they can go and they can try it. And the price was low enough that, you know, it was sort of minimal risk involved. If they dropped out, then, you know, there wasn't sort of no harm, no foul. That's not true anymore. The risk involved is substantial. Because if somebody goes and does that and then leaves with, you know, they don't leave with a ton, and they leave like with about maybe $5,000 in debt. That $5,000 hanging over the head of essentially a high school graduate is pretty tough to stomach. And the truth is that those people who did not graduate but have small amounts of debt are the ones who are defaulting. So when we hear about the student loan crisis, we keep hearing about people with tons of debt. Those are actually not the people we need to be most worried about. The smaller debt is the debt that's actually ruining people's lives because it's matched with a lack of a college degree and a very low income.
And those payments to pay off the college debt, where is that money going? Is that money staying in Wisconsin or is it going somewhere else?
It depends on who made the loan, but I mean, in this current system where essentially the federal government is making the loans for the most part, it's going back to Washington. And, you know, the real problem is that folks are paying interest. They're not even able to pay down, you know, the principal that well. So these debts hang around for quite some time. You know, I think your listeners would benefit from hearing about a contrast. I think we know how to keep debt down. You know, so the University of Wisconsin-Madison graduates have actually pretty low debt compared to the, you know, the national average. only half of the students at Madison borrow, and they graduate with an average of $26,000 in debt. Now, the reason they're able to do that is that the state spends far more resources subsidizing the tuition at Madison than it does at other places. In addition, Madison has an endowment that's quite large, so it's able to provide additional grants to students. Moreover, the people who attend Madison are people disproportionately whose families have money. What all of that means is it adds up to less debt for students, and that's a good situation. Contrast that with the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where 33% of people there are on the Pell Grant, which means they don't have much of an income at all. At the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, 73% of people have debt, and the debt is $33,000 a year. That's the average, way above the state average and the national average. So I think we know what we need to do. We need to subsidize the tuition, and we need to have families that have resources. All of our families across this country should make more than they do right now, and we need to have endowments to subsidize that further for students. But the problem is we don't do that, especially in the places like Milwaukee where families are struggling the most.
Let's take a call from Jake in Twin Lakes. Hi, Jake.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I appreciate you guys are finally talking about this because I graduated from high school about a year ago, a year and a half maybe, and I actually wanted to go to college, and I'm one of those people where I didn't have a family that was born into money or anything, so I have to work for everything on my own. And looking at how intimidating the prices of college would be after graduating just really turned me off to the idea because I don't know where I'm going to be when I graduate, so I don't want to be stuck with this massive amount of debt when I'm out and not know what to do with it. So, yeah, like it's just, you know, these $30,000 a year colleges, I mean, it's just insane. It really turns people off to going to get a higher education.
And let's go right to another call to try to sneak another perspective in. Elizabeth in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I just want to also thank you for talking about this. I recently graduated from college in 2013. I graduated top 10% of my class in high school. And going into college, I had to take out loans. I applied for tons of scholarships. And I still walked away with $30,000 in debt. And it is very difficult. I come from a family that didn't have much income. I have younger siblings.
I'm sorry, Elizabeth, we're losing you there. But Sarah, two perspectives there. Someone who didn't go to college because of the prospect of debt and someone who kind of had the dream experience of getting a lot of top scholarships and still came out with $30,000 in debt.
Yeah, this is terrible. I mean, to be honest, first of all, the first student that you talked to, I mean, this is talent loss for the state of Wisconsin. It's happening across the country. We can look at very academically able students with high ambitions who are turning away from college now because of the price. That is not going to help our economy. And your other person, you know, you can hear again, she's very smart and she's got these scholarships. In the past, that person would be all set. Here you are doing all of that great work, $30,000 in debt. The message that sends to people is really problematic. I have heard from young people across Wisconsin with this sort of debt that they're reconsidering whether they would send their own children to college in the future. I don't think that's going to be a very good situation for our state.
And as we said, there's bound to be an impact on the economy with so many people shouldering this kind of debt.
Well, that's right. Now, I mean, I do have to say, the debt by itself is probably not doing that much damage to the economy, but the problem is that this is debt in the context of an already weak economy. We already are still struggling to come out of the recession, and that by itself is already contributing to lower rates of things like homeownership and consumption. So the debt in that context is particularly bad, and that's the problem with this entire situation, which is that it seems like we created a system for college financing that relies on all of our families having lots of money and our economy doing really well.
Well, we will definitely be continuing to follow this, especially since the state legislature is considering a bill to create a state-based authority to help student loan borrowers. So we will check in with you again on this, I'm sure, Sarah.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Sarah Goldrick-Robb, founding director of the Wisconsin Hope Lab and professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about the rising cost of college in Wisconsin.